We're having our first class in Ein Yaakov, and we're going to divide our introduction to two. It's always important to read introductions to works. And in truth, we could spend all semester reading the introductions to this work, to the Ein Yaakov, and the time wouldn't be wasted. It would be interesting and important. Nonetheless, my feeling is that usually if you spend too much time on the introduction, people get bored and leave. So I always try to learn the introduction slowly and have the first few minutes of the class on the introduction and then start the work so that people get a taste of what we're going to do. And that's why we're going to divide the introduction between this class and next class and possibly another class. I also am in the process of writing out an English handout summarizing a little bit of the history of this work. And we're going to focus on that in our next class, God willing. Next week we're going to focus on who the author was, when it was written, the time period, the Spanish Inquisition, the burning of the Talmud, and the implications on this work. For tonight, we're going to focus in our introduction on a different point, and that is the general understanding of Agadot, the stories in the Shas. This work, the Ein Yaakov, the stories of the Talmud and the stories in the Medrash, the Ein Yaakov is really a compilation written by a contemporary of Rav Yosef Karo, someone who preceded him slightly, was banished from Spain in the Spanish Inquisition. And the Beis Yosef quotes this work in the Laws of Tisha B'Av. He quotes the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov puts together for us the stories of the Talmud. The father wrote the first two volumes and then passed away, and his son completed the last four volumes. And basically he takes from the Shas, he boils it down to the different stories in the Shas, and he quotes the different commentaries, their explanations, just so we get a picture of what the times looked like when he wrote it. We're going to expand on this next week, but he spent many years, much of his life, yearning to write this work, but could not write it because he couldn't get his hands on a Talmud. He was traveling from city to city, and no city had a complete copy of the Talmud, of the commentaries on the Talmud. So what he was doing over here was putting together a work which summarizes, which quotes from the Talmud, but skips the halachos of the Talmud and just puts together the different stories of the Talmud, the agados. Now, this is a work that was learned throughout the ages. There were periods in Jewish history where throughout much of Europe you couldn't get your hands on a Talmud, but you could get your hands on this. Because when the church ordered to burn the Talmud, so there were periods when they permitted this to be printed, but would not permit the Talmud to be printed. So you'd have communities where they could learn this and they couldn't learn the Talmud. So that we'll discuss next week, why they burnt the Talmud and why they allowed this to remain. That we're going to leave for next week in our discussions of the burning of the Talmud and the censorship, etc. So the Ein Yaakov is going to be a fascinating work, which throughout the generations, the Balabatim, the people who were not learned, would love to learn, because on the one hand, you're learning Gemara text. On the other hand, it's relatively easy and relatively interesting. Sometimes it's more interesting, and sometimes it's even more interesting. So you got to be a little bit long-winded, because sometimes this story won't catch you, but the next one will. And my goal is to go from the first page to the last page. My goal is, God willing, throughout the years, we should run through it. And that's why I'm starting in the beginning, even though this isn't necessarily the most fascinating tractate. Brachos has a lot of very interesting stories. But if we start in the beginning, then I hope it will entice us, even after we leave the Machon, to follow online, as do many of the people who come to the Machon. We've had people who came here for a day or 2 days and are still following. We have a student out in the Ukraine who spent 2 days in this class, and to this day he's still following our classes. So it's up to you. It's up to you how much you follow and how much you don't follow. We have people listening all over the world who never attended a class. Sometimes I meet people after they've been listening online for years, and now it's up to you. So that's why I wanted to start with the beginning, so that way it'll encourage us to follow through. And now I want the focus of our introduction tonight to be to try and understand a little bit, in general, what do Chazal mean with their stories? How are we supposed to understand them? Yeah?
I'm just quickly asking, is this part of Gemara or part of...
So this is, you have the Talmud, and what he did was he boiled down the Talmud to the stories of the Talmud.
So I'm allowed to study. This is what I'm asking, because the rabbis say I shouldn't study.
Ask whoever your rabbi is. Whoever is your rabbi, ask him. I don't know what I don't know the Machon policy on all this. So,
what's your opinion?
My opinion is that the Machon has specific policies with regard to all this, and I don't know what the policies are. So find out.
Good answer.
He asked, people in the Geir program are told not to attend Talmud classes. Is this included? My answer is, check it out with the Machon, not with me. I don't know what the Machon policy is. I'm not getting involved. You have whoever is guiding you throughout your gear process. Ask them.
So I'll do it for today for the introduction, then I'll ask them. I think we're focusing on two classes that are the big huge here. Is
people why should they do the gear? And then the other one.
Okay. So. We're going to try to focus on a few points in our introduction tonight. Firstly, we're going to try to avoid pitfalls that people enter when they read the stories of the Talmud. When the rabbis used to teach, so all week long they had their students, who were people that were living lives of sheer poverty, starvation, and their families were also joining them in this Mesiut Nefesh, to learn Torah at a price that was really near death. They were eating vegetation that grew around their house. You have Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, who has about a Coke bottle's worth volume of carob growing on his tree, and that's what he eats all week. Doesn't have that much more than that. Think about that. That's his meal every day of the week, including Shabbos. And this wasn't only in the time of the Talmud, but in the time of the tour. Carob. He had a carob tree. Carob. C-A-R-O-B. Carob. Charuvin. He had a kav charuvin for himself. That was his food for the week. And he never complained. He was happy with that. And even in the time of the tour, the Rush's son, the Rush was rabbi first in Ashkenaz and later on in Spain. And the Rush's son, the tour, writes that he couldn't afford to buy anything in honor of Shabbos. He was being sustained by the community, and he couldn't even buy a simple piece of fish. He couldn't afford anything for Shabbos. His Shabbos meal was like his weekday meal, whatever small amount of bread or whatever it was he ate during the week. That's what he had for Shabbos as well. He asked his father, how can I honor the Shabbos if it's at the expense of the community? They're the ones that are giving me my paycheck. So he says this was an issue he had. He felt like he's not honoring the Shabbos. But this is the way people live. And the average person worked from before sunrise till sunset. The Gemara says, what's considered a lazy person, the Medrash says? A lazy person is one who gets up around sunrise. He's lazy. Everyone else is out of work already. He's only getting up at sunrise. So the average person didn't have much time to learn. And the average person not only didn't have much time to learn, but we find that they didn't know almost anything. Your average Am Haaretz did not know how to say Shema in the morning and in the evening, did not know how to make a blessing, Birchas Hamazon, after their food. You had a situation where the pyramid was such that at the top, you had rabbis who were so great they could resurrect the dead. You had rabbis who knew the Talmud by heart, who were masters of Talmud and tradition, and then the middle class was missing, and the bottom class, the Am Haaretz, were people who very often didn't know how to read, and very often didn't know the most basic mitzvot, they didn't know anything. And the only way that the rabbis could teach these people was on Shabbos. All week long they were working. You couldn't bring them to a class. And so the rabbis took advantage on Shabbos. They made a decree. People wanted to connect with the Torah. So Shabbos afternoon, they'd sit down and read Job, read Mishle, read Proverbs. And in the time of the Mishnah, the rabbis decreed that no man may read Tanakh. You're not allowed to read the stories of the writings on Shabbos. And this was in order to ensure that people wouldn't stay home, but rather they'd come to the speech, and the rabbis would give a speech, a long speech, Shabbos afternoon. And in that speech, they teach the people all the laws they have to know. They teach them you're not allowed to steal. They teach them you have to be kind to your fellow man. You have to be extra kind to the orphan. They teach them the laws of meat and milk. And they spiced these speeches with stories. Now, to the common folk, the stories were what was interesting. And through the stories, they teach them halachos. So they ask the question, if there's a sick person, if there's a woman giving birth, and you need to put out the light for her, or you need to turn on a light for her, what may you do? So instead of just saying you may or may not turn on or put out the light, they'd start discussing about how the soul is the light of God in this world. That's God's flame that God lights in this world. And certainly you put out a smaller flame for the sake of a bigger flame, giving them answers that really, the basis for the answer is not the real halachic basis for the answer. But it was an agadic form of expressing the answer, a form which the people would remember on the one hand and would entice them to come on the other hand. And as the generations went on, they had to give more and more stories and spice the stories with halacha, instead of, as the earlier generations had it, that they'd give a lot of halacha and spice it with stories. Now, these stories, on the surface, are just interesting and wondrous stories. And our tradition is that all of these stories have tremendous depth. And the secrets of the Torah are concealed within these stories. And when we read these stories, we're going to read them on the surface, like the Amei Aretz, like the common folk. But we have to be careful not to think that the understandings that we have are their real understandings. They are the understanding on the simple level. But Chazal did not mean them on the simple level. Chazal had a code with which they spoke to their students. And they embossed, they embellished the secrets of the Torah in these stories. So they tell a story, and the students would know how to derive from that story what the true message was. And to the common folk, it was just a story. It was interesting, it was fascinating. As we read through the stories, we have to remember there's more depth to the stories. And as we read through the stories, we have to take care, on the one hand, to recognize that there is more depth. And on the other hand, not to dissuade ourselves into thinking that we understand that depth. We could fool ourselves and try giving all kinds of explanations. And I'd much rather say, I don't understand, than to say, I understand that it means such and such and such. A good question is much better than a bad answer. And our attitude has to be, this is interesting, this is going to open our eyes, this is going to give us a certain element of understanding, but this isn't all there is to be said. This is just scratching the surface. King Solomon taught us that when we read the words of the sages, we have to know that there are multiple understandings, and we are instructed in the beginning of Proverbs, in the beginning of Mishlei, Lehavin mashal umelitza divrei chachamim v'chidotam. To understand both the simple understanding when they tell us an allegory. So the first understanding is the simple understanding. And that understanding has a message. They would not give us a mashal, a story, that represents a deeper meaning when at the surface it doesn't have a meaning that is important to be understood. Even the stories that have deeper meanings on the surface level also have a meaning which is important to be understood. So we have to remember that on the one hand, we're only going to scratch the surface, but on the other hand, that scratching the surface has its own value. There's the militza, there's the simple understanding. If they're telling us a story about a man who's coming home from work and he's walking by the corner and he has to be careful because different things are coming and approaching him and there are different tests along his way, so we know that that's a reference to a person in philosophy and a person's way through life in philosophy and how a person's going to be attracted to incorrect philosophies, etc. We know our sages revealed to us the depth of that allegory. But even the simple understanding, when a person comes home, which crosswalks to cross, what area to go through, that's also an important message. And that's why we're going to learn this, to get a taste, to be familiar with the stories of the Shas, and also because there's a value to the simple understanding. And I strongly recommend you stay with this class, because as with all our classes, we're going to try to cover ground, And there's tremendous satisfaction when you finish a book. And in this class, Be'ezrat Hashem, it is going to be possible to finish Masechet after Masechet. And at least you'll know you finished the stories of the Masechta. That's also worth a lot. One of the concepts that we're going to encounter in the stories, in the Agadot of the Shas, one of the things we're going to see is that Chazal seem to give explanations to nature. Chazal will take natural phenomena, lightning, thunder, eclipse, all kinds of things that happen in nature, and Chazal will give reasons for these phenomena. We have to take care to know that Chazal are not telling us the natural cause for these phenomena. When Chazal say that when there is a miscarriage of justice, there will be an eclipse, they don't mean that if there's a court case and the judge takes a bribe, the next day there'll be an eclipse. When Chazal tell us reasons for occurrences in nature, the Maharal explains what they are telling us is why God made the world in a way that these natural phenomena occur. They are not telling us a direct cause and effect, that when there is a miscarriage of justice, then there will be an eclipse. When the Roman Empire is on its way down, then there's going to be a solar eclipse. And a lunar eclipse is when there are problems for the Jews. It doesn't mean that there's a direct correlation day to day between these natural phenomena and what's happening on earth. It means that when God created the world, God made these natural phenomena an occurrence within this world as a representation of a response to phenomena which happen, which we control. So we're learning, when we learn these things in the Shas, we're learning the cause for the cause. You guys with me? There's a natural cause, and then what's the cause that God made it that this natural cause would be able to have this effect? That's what we're learning. The cause for the cause, but not the direct cause. The Rambam's son, Rabbi Avram ben Arambam, has a famous letter in which he writes that people sometimes take the stories of the Shas, they take them at literal value, and they insist that it must be the way it says in the Shas. If the Shas explains that naturally this is what occurs, this is what occurs. If the Shas describes a story that someone got off a ship and they started walking throughout an island and then suddenly the island started moving and they discovered it was a huge whale, well, it must mean there are some huge whales out there that have islands on their back. And says the Rambam son, these people think they're very pious and they insist that just like every word of the Talmud is true, this is also true. And when they're going to be proven that this isn't so, that naturally this is not so, so then they'll be forced to discard this belief that everything that says in the Talmud is literally true, and together with it they'll chuck all the other things that are true in the Talmud. So the Rambam says, the Rambam's son, Rabbi Avram ben Arambam, says that's an incorrect attitude. Chazal told us things in nature. We have to know how to understand those things in nature. But those things in nature are not on the same level as the other parts of the tradition that we have. There's a lot more to be discussed, but for now, let's begin. The Ein Yaakov begins by quoting the Mishnah that the Gemara is going on. And we're going to run through it, and I'm going to read the Hebrew and translate, because I think that everyone can gain from that. As much as you gain, you gain. If you don't understand something, stop me. But I'm going to try to go relatively quickly, just to, so it remains interesting. I'm not reading the commentaries. I'm going to try to summarize them as we read. Those of you who are interested could read them every so often when there's a commentary that's very relevant or that's very important. I might read it. But in general, I'm going to try to summarize them. We're beginning with the first Mishnah in Shas, the first Masechet. Tractate is Brachot, discussing blessings. And let's begin. The first subject that's going to be discussed is when does one say the evening Shema? We know that one is supposed to say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, together with the whole parsha and the other two parshas that we place adjacent to them, twice a day. Biblically, one's supposed to say it when one awakens and when one goes to sleep. The rabbis added another time in the morning prayer in Korbanos, and another time in the evening when one is about to fall asleep, they added another time. They ended up that we say four times a day. On Shabbos we add. We say Shema Yisrael in the Kedusha of Musaf. We say Shema Yisrael when we take out the Sefer Torah. So on Mondays and Thursdays we end up saying Shema Yisrael five times a day, three times rabbinic and twice biblical. And on Shabbos and Yom Tov we say it six times a day. Let's continue. Meimatai Korin Shema Be'Avin. From when must we read Shema in the evenings when we are fulfilling this biblical obligation to read Shema every night? So the Mishnah responds, Mishasha Kohanim Nichnasin Lechol B'Trumatan. From the time that the Kohanim are pure, from the time that nightfall sets, and the Kohanim may enter to eat their holy food of Truma. So then, Kohanim who were impure and went to immersed in the mikvah waters, when it becomes nightfall, Tzeisa Kohanim, they become pure. From that hour, one may begin, one may reach Kriya Shema. Until when? Atzof Hashmua Rishona. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer says, until the first watching. And we're going to learn in the Gemara that in heavens there are watchings. God has His own army, and God fashioned His army after the armies that are here on earth. And just like here on earth, you have mishmarot, you have different watches. One guy guards the night for a third, and the next guy guards the night for two, the second third of the night, and the next guy guards the third third. So too in heavens, there's a changing of the guard as the night is divided into thirds. So Rabbi Eliezer is of the opinion that one may read Shema until a third into the night. Those of you who are participants in our Pikud Rabbi Eliezer class on Thursday nights, it's worthwhile to note that the first Tana that shows up in Shas is Rabbi Eliezer. This Rabbi Eliezer who didn't start learning till the age of 27, who became the greatest rabbi, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurknus. Yeah.
So what time is it?
Wait, this is one opinion. V'chachamim umim, and the rabbis held, one may say Shema at Chatzot, till the middle of the night. Rabban Gamliel omer, Rabban Gamliel was of the opinion that one may say Shema at She'aleh Amud HaShachar, till the beginning of morning, which is an hour and 15 minutes, an hour and 12 minutes, an hour and 30 minutes before Nates, before one can begin seeing the ball of the sun. The Rambam rules like Rabban Gamliel, like everyone rules. We rule halacha that one may say it till the morning. One should ideally say it before midnight, but one may say it till alos ha-shachar. And there are more details which we might encounter in the Yaakov. Maaseh, a story happened. Uval v'nav mi bet ha-mishteh, his sons came from a party. Amru lo, they told their father, lo karinu et shema. Dad, we've been out all night, there's been a chasana, we haven't read shema. Amar lahem, so he said to them, im lo ala amud ha-shachar, chayvim tem nikot. If the morning has not yet begun, you are obligated to read the shema. They said to him, look, the rabbis hold, we may only read till midnight. You hold till the morning. Ordinarily, if there's an argument between you and the rabbis win. When the rabbis said until midnight, did they mean that one may not read past midnight? Or do they also concede that one may read past midnight? One should ideally read prior to midnight, but one may read after midnight. And he responded, he said, even the rabbis agree that if you haven't read by midnight, then read after midnight. Velozo vilvad amru, and not only this, Rabbi Gamliel told his children, elakol mashamu chachmim ad chatzot, mitzvatan ad she'aleh amud ha-shachar. Anything that the rabbi said one must do till midnight, so then really the obligation is until the morning, but the rabbis said to midnight to help us, because if a person says, oh, I got all night, he'll end up missing it. So the rabbi said, get it done by midnight. What are examples of that? Ekter chalvim ve'varim. When we have to bring up the fats and the different limbs of the sacrifices and we have to do it at night, mitzvatan ad she'aleh amud ha-shachar. Really, the mitzvah is to do it all night long. V'chol ne'chalim liyom echad, and the different sacrifices that have to be eaten by the end of the night, also mitzvatan ad she'aleh amud ha-shachar. The mitzvah is to complete them by the morning. Imken, if the mitzvah is really all night long, lama amru chachmim ad chatzot, why did the sages tell us get it done by midnight? Kedei la'achik adam min averat, to distance us from sinning. They said, if a person thinks he has all night long, he'll say, I'll get to it. And how many times does this person say, I'll get to it, and he never gets to it? People go to a chasana, they say, I'll daven ma'ariv, I'll still catch ma'ariv. Right now they're serving the main course. How many times do they end up going to sleep without davening ma'ariv? So Chazal said, don't think on you'll get to it. Get it done before midnight. Get it done early. Mechdi, so the Gemara says, let's analyze this. When do the Kohanim eat Truma? The Mishnah said one may start reading Shema from the time the Kohanim can eat Truma. When is that time? Mishatzet Kohavim. From the time three medium stars, small stars, come out. Why doesn't the Mishnah just say you could start reading Shema from the time the stars come out? Answers the Gemara, Milta Gavucha Kamashmalan. It taught us another thing, by the way. Kohanim Mimat Kachli B'Truma Mishatzet Kohavim. It taught us, by the way, if you want to know when can Kohanim start eating Truma, from the time three small stars come out. V'ha Kamashmalan D'chapara Lo Me'akva. It taught us that even a Kohen that must bring a sacrifice in order to complete his purification process, he doesn't have to wait for that sacrifice to eat the holy Truma. K'detanya, as the Brisa derived, Uva Shemesh V'Tachir B'yad Shimshom Ha'Kvatom L'Chol B'Truma V'en Kaparatom Ha'Kvatom L'Chol B'Truma. The Brisa derives it from the verse. Now we're learning the words. The sun comes. What does it mean, the sun comes? And the word tahol. What does the word tahol mean? Tahol means pure. But here we see that the Gemara teaches us what the real meaning of the word tahol means. I am four lines from the top, right next to the parentheses. The Gemara says that when this verse says the sun will come and it will be tahol, tahol doesn't mean the man will be pure, but rather the word tahol means to be finished off, to be completely removed. Let me ask you a question. We have the word kadosh, we have the word tahol, we have the word tameh. A person in his natural state, what is he? Is he kadosh, tahol, tameh?
He's in between.
So from this Gemara,
he can be tameh, he can be kadosh, he can be.
Right now we are all tameh.
At any given time, he can go, he can be whatever.
That's true. But let's think. What's neutral? Let's word it differently. What's considered neutral? I'm not saying where are we today. What is neutral? You know, you put a car in neutral, it's not moving forward, it's not moving backward. What is neutral? So the answer, the correct answer is, like you said, tahol. How do we know that? From this Gemara. This Gemara tells us that the word tahol means removal of. So what is tahol? Tahol is when you've removed tuma. So we have the level when he's minus one, that's tameh. When he's zero, that's tahol. What's tahol? Tahol simply means he is not tameh, he's removed tumah. That's what this Gemara says. That when the verse states, the sun will come and it will be tahol, it means the sun will come and will be completely removed, meaning the sun will completely set. So the Gemara says, how do you know that that's what the verse means? So let's go back to what we were discussing a second ago. We have tameh, that's when a person is spiritually defiled, he's one step down. We have tahol, that's when the tumah left him, he's no longer tameh, he's neutral. And then we have kadosh, that's one step up. That's why the Kohanim, when they enter to do service in the Beit HaMikdash, they're pure, there's nothing wrong with them. They have to do kiddush yadayim v'raglayim. They have to give holiness to their hands and feet, they wash them again. But their hands aren't defiled. What are they washing? That's kedusha. That's the next level. Kedusha is holiness, that's above the neutral. Tahol is neutral, that's the removal of tumah, and that's what this Gemara is saying. The Gemara says, when the verse states that the Kohanim may eat the holy food of Truma when the sun sets and it will be tahol, what will be tahol? The Kohen or the sun? The Gemara says the sun. The sun will set and will be completely removed from earth. That's tahol. That's what the verse means in that verse. Uva Hashemesh, and the sun will set, v'taher, and will complete its setting. So the Gemara says, how do you know that? Maybe taher means the person. Dilma biyatoro, maybe it means the sun will set. Umay v'tahel ta'agava, and what it means is the gentleman will be tahol. Amar Rabba bar Rav Sheila, Rabba the son of Rav Sheila said, imken lemakra v'gital, then the verse should have said, v'gital, and he will become tahol. May v'tahel, what does it mean grammatically, and it will become tahol? Tehal yoma, it means the day will become tahol. Kedam inshi, as people ordinarily say, Yerev Shimsha, the sun set, the Adchiyoma, and the day's been purified. So we see that the word purify means complete removal of something. Pure is removal of impurity. Pure is the removal of Tumah. In the west, which is where? We're learning the Babylonian Talmud. When it refers to the west, it's talking about Israel, right? Babylon's to the east of Israel. So whenever they refer to the west, they're talking about Israel. They didn't have this tradition of analyzing the verse. Uvalu, and they asked the question, ובאו לו מבעיה, היי ובאי שמש בעת שמשו, ומה ותאר תאר יומה, ודילמה בעת אורו, ומה ותאר תאר גברה. They asked, how do we understand the verse? Is it referring to the gentleman becoming pure, or the day being pure? והדר פשטולה מברייתא, and they derived the answer from a Tanai quote, מדיקטני בברייתא סמן דבר צאת כוכבים, being that it says in the Braisa, you want to know when's the sign for that the day that the Kohanim are pure, see the small stars come out. From here we see that it's referring to the day that the sun will set and will be purified. In other words, there will be no more sun on earth. Let me ask you a question. When we say that nightfall begins when three small stars come out, what do we mean by that? Do we mean that the definition of night is when three small stars come out? Or do we mean that the definition of night is night? And the sign for when it's nightfall is when you see three small stars. Are three small stars part of the definition, or are they a sign for what the time is?
Sign.
Oh, so our Gemara just said, siman ledavah. You want to see a sign that the nightfall began? Look for three small stars. It's a sign. It's not a definer. Amar Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi taught us. Ben Hashmashot. We know there's a time that's called Ben Hashmashot, in between the suns. Meaning there's day, there's night, and there's twilight. There's something in between. And we've discussed in the past whether this is a true concept or it's a man-made concept. Meaning, when God created night and day, it says God created night and God created day. Did God only create night and day? Or did God create day, twilight, night? Meaning, will there ever be a second when I will ask God what time it is and God will say it's twilight? Or is twilight just a result of our limitations in defining when it's day and when it's night? Is it a halachic, a man-made concept? Or is it a true concept, a concept that really exists in creation? You guys got the difference?
The night's already there. Man.
We know there's night, we know there's day. Is twilight just a period which we can't define? Or is it a creation that God created?
It's a border between two countries. So like you have a country there, you have a country there, and the border, there's nothing. There's no country, there's nothing of both, there's something else.
Okay.
The Torah says that Hashem created night, doesn't say
it's like
that.
It's like a boundary.
Hashem created light out of it.
A boundary.
That's what it says.
So you're saying that we don't find a verse that explicitly states that God created twilight. But, do you remember what it says in Pirkei Avot? It says that 10 things were created in twilight. So how could God create in twilight if twilight doesn't exist by God?
I guess in the Bereshit, it doesn't say Hashem created the darkness. It just says that everything was void and it was dark.
Right?
Light was created to have twilight.
I don't want to discuss that because I don't begin to understand those verses, so let's leave it. I don't know what it means. Rashi over there has a few understandings. I don't know what it means. So Rabbi Yossi teaches us the following. Ben Hashmashot, this period of twilight, is keheref ayin, like the bat of an eyelash. Zeh nichnas vezeh yotzeh v'yifshal amod alav. In 1 second, it's in and out, and you can't figure out when is twilight. Now, this opinion of Rav Yossi, there are two opinions in the Gemara, whether Ben Hashmashot is like this or like that. Rabbi Yehuda holds that Ben Hashmashot takes 9 minutes, and Rabbi Yossi holds it's a bat of an eyelash. And there are many Gvorot which expand on this. Here, the Ein Yaakov just quoted this quote, that Rabbi Yossi's opinion is that twilight is the bat of an eyelash. We'll see. We'll get there. That's a Gemara coming up. I don't think it is, but we'll see the Gemara. Maybe I misunderstood. We said one may read Shema ad sofa shmura rishona divrei Rebbe Eliezer. Rebbe Eliezer holds you may read Shema till the end of the first watching. Maika savar Rebbe Eliezer. What does Rebbe Eliezer hold? Ika savar gimel mishmot avei alayla lema dalet shot. Ika savar dal mishmot avei alayla lema gimel shot. There are two opinions the Gemara is going to quote. One opinion holds that you divide the night watchings into three, and one opinion holds you divide it into four. Which way does Rebbe Eliezer hold? If he held that the night watchings are divided into three, he should have said you could read Shema till 4 hours into the night. If he held the night watchings are divided into four, he should have said you can read it up to 3 hours into the night. Before we continue, we have to define hours. In the Mishnah, in the Gemara, anytime we discuss hours, we apply the Rambam's definition. The Rambam in Perusha Mishnayis explains that we have a concept called Sha'ot Zmaniyot. You divide the hours based upon the daylight hours. So if sunrise is at 5 a.m. and sunset is at 7 p.m., then you have 14 hours of sunlight. You divide 14, you take 14 times 60 minutes, you get 740, right? 7,400 minutes in a day. 7,400 minutes of light. Divide them by 12, and you end up having each hour is an hour and 10 minutes, right? Each hour is 70 minutes. And when we say you could reach Shema until 3 hours into the day, it means you count 3 times 70. You take a quarter of the day, a quarter of the daylight hours. Now, if you think about it, it's very logical. They were working with sundials. Sundials are divided into 12 parts, and that's how you measure time. So when they were working with sundials, when they discussed a third of the day, they meant a third of the day. So when our and they did the same thing with night. Now, the only thing is, yeah?
Why is time time? Why we say an hour is 60 minutes, why we don't say it's 70 minutes? Why we say a second is a second?
So in the time of the Gemara, when they said an hour, ordinarily, that's what they meant. They meant...
70 minutes.
They didn't mean 70 minutes. They meant... If they said 3 hours into the day, they meant a quarter of the day. They called every day a 12-hour day, and whenever they said an hour was variable, depending on the time of year. The only thing that's pretty much constant is noon. But everything else is variable. Right?
In the winter, it's less than 7 minutes.
In the winter, yeah, an hour is can be 45 minutes. So it's not defined. It depends on how many daylight hours you have. There's more to be discussed, but for now, let's leave it at that. So, when we're talking about nighttime, so we're doing the same thing. If Rabbi Lezer says you could reach Shema until the end of the first watching, so he means either a third of the night or a quarter of the night. So why didn't he just say 3 or 4 hours into the night? So the Gemara says, "Lolam kasava gim mishmot avelayla." Rabbi Lezer really holds you divide the night into thirds. And he meant you could read into a third of the night. V'haka mashmalan. And the reason he said up until the end of the first watching was in order to allude to us, to teach us, v'ika mishmot v'kia v'ika mishmot ma'ara, that the watchings in heavens correspond to the watchings on earth. Just like you have a change of guard here on earth, right? The soldiers don't stay guard all night long. They change guards. So God made it that the heavenly guards change at the same time as the earthly guards. So if you're sitting in the army and the guards are changing a third of the night, you know that's it. You finish the time of Shema. You can't reach Shema anymore, according to Rabbi Eliezer. So Rabbi Eliezer purposely used terminology which can be interchanged for earthly guards or heavenly guards to teach us this concept that the heavenly guards correspond to the earthly guards. Now today maybe the army does it differently, but in those days it corresponded.
Exact same time correspond?
Ah, so maybe we got that. Seems like it had exact correspondence, yeah. Ditanya, for we have a Tanaik quote, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Shalosh Mishmarot Havei Alayla. The night is divided into three watchings. Val kol mishmar u'mishmar, and over each watching, as the guards change, Yoshev HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'shoeh Kari. God sits and gives a roar like a lion. Shneimar, as the verse states in Jeremiah, Hashem Mimarom Yishag, God lets out a roar from way up high, umimeon kotsho, and from his dwelling place of holiness, yiten kolo, he gives off his voice, shaogi shagal naveu, a roar he roars over his home. So three times in that verse it mentions that God roars. So from here we derive that three times a night God roars, and what's he roaring about? He's roaring about his home, about the temple that's been destroyed. The siman nidavan, if you want to know a sign, how you recognize when these times are taking place, Mishmarah Rishonah, when the first watching changes, Chamor Noer, that's the time that ordinarily donkeys neigh. Shnia, the second watching, is when Klavim Tzoakim, dogs yelp. Shlishit, and the third watching, is when Tinok Yonek Mishdei Imo, the babies get up to suck. V'isham sapert im ba'ala, and the woman starts talking with her husband. It's a time just before people are waking up. And what? So, oh, Tosfos asks that point. Tosfos asks, if the wife's talking to her husband, when's he reading Shema?
Yeah.
When's he praying? Okay. Wait, we didn't say Hashem is angry. We said Hashem is roaring over the destruction of the temple, and we're going to see what the relevance of that is. But tonight, we're almost out of time. So, we'll try to finish this. The Gemara says, wait a second, when Rav Lezer gave us these signs, what was he indicating to us with these signs? If he meant you want to know when the beginning of each watching is, meaning a mule neighs at sunset, and the dogs will wail a third into the night, and a baby starts nursing, and the wife speaks to her husband two thirds into the night. So then, why did I need a sign for the beginning of the first watching? Utu, I see it turns dark. Now, this is a very strange question that the Gemara is asking. Because if he gave me a sign, it's supposed to be something which I could easily see. So why didn't the Gemara just go out and see? When does a mule neigh? Why didn't the Gemara see? When do horses yelp? We have a rule that the Gemara doesn't question things that are easily discernible. If you can go out to nature and check out the answers, then that's not something the Gemara is going to discuss. The Gemara doesn't waste its time telling us things that you could verify on your own from nature. The Gemara won't argue about such things. Sof mishma kachashiv, if Rabbi Lezer came to give me a sign, when is the end of each watching? Sof mishma chonasim nalamali, why do you have to give me a sign for the end of the last watching? Imamo, I see, it's daylight. Ela chashiv sof mishma rishona, so we say, strange answer. Rabbi Lezer gave us the sign, when's the end of the first watching? That's when a mule neighs. V'tchilat mishma achona, and when does a baby start sucking? The beginning of the last watching, two thirds into the night. And he gave us a sign for the middle of the middle one, that's when dogs are yelling. You'll tell me, what do I need the last one? What do I need it for? If I hear a baby sucking, so then I know it's time to read the morning Shema. I'm sorry, I skipped. Rabbi Lezer taught us how to discern when are the end of the watchings. You'll tell me, what do I need a sign for the last watching? I see the daylight as it's approaching. What do I need it for? In order to reach Shema, for one who's sleeping in a dark house. He doesn't want Shema. The shutters are down. Everything's dark. We want the baby to sleep. When he hears his wife starting to talk to him, and the baby's starting to nurse, so he knows he's got to say, honey, I got to go reach Shema. It's getting late. So then, Lekum Malikri has to get up and read Shema.
It's a good excuse to stop talking. I bet this one of the reasons we say Shema in the morning.
We're just going to... We'll run through the last two lines. Amar Yitzhak Bar Shmuel Amarav. Rav Yitzhak, the son of Shmuel, said in the name of Rav. Rav is the first generation of Amoraim, the disciple of Rebbe, who compiled the Mishnah. Gimel Mishmo Tavi Alayla. The night is composed of three watchings. V'akom Mishmo Mishmo Yosheva Kadosh Baruch Hu V'shoek Kari. And over each watching, God roars like a lion. V'omer, and God says, Oy Shechavti Et Beiti. Woe that I destroyed my temple. Woe to my sons that their sins caused that I destroyed my home. V'saravti Techali, and I burnt my holy place. And I exiled my children to among the nations. And because we say that in this time in heaven there's some arousal of sorrow over the situation of the temple and the Jewish people, these are times which we say in halacha that one should try and pray times at night. And if he can't do it at night, then do it by day. A third of the day, two thirds, or the end of the day. There are times when one should try and pray or say Tehillim over the destruction of the temple, over the fact that the Jews are exiled, and this is what's commonly known as Tikkun Chatzot. Yeah? Okay. Kaf HaChaim holds, he quotes Kabbalists that say you shouldn't say Tehillim at night. I wouldn't worry about it. Kabbalistically, it's better not to, but I wouldn't worry about it. Yeah? So obviously, that's what I say. I wouldn't worry about it. One second. He's in the middle of something. Yeah.
the watching, is it the angels change to God? I don't get it.
So remind me next time, we'll try to discuss it. Okay? Yeah?
So that's assuming that unless it's not a physical explanation, that the mule, the baby, the wife, at the exact same time every single night.
We said that that's a simple understanding, but there's a problem with that because the Gemara has... And then the Gemara says two possible understandings as to what time is discussed. Now, if it's such a clear sign, then...
So I guess I just didn't understand the clarity in that, unless we have...
We didn't say any clarity in that. We said that the thing is unclear. Maybe next time we'll try to give...
Okay. Come on.